All right, well now, last week, I hope I established that the true gross product of the economy is much greater than the consumer's goods. It goes far beyond the so-called final product. It includes all of the capital goods or intermediate goods. In effect, the true gross product is not the bread alone. It's not the bread plus the net change in inventories. It's the bread, the flour, and the wheat. That's the true gross product. That, nevertheless, is treated as though it's an error to think that way. It's called the error of double counting. And I think I showed that this is not double counting. That the final product, the bread, does not count anything beyond itself. The bread does not count the flour and the wheat in addition to itself. The bread counts the bread, or the value added by the baker plus the flour, which is still nothing but the bread, or the values added by the baker and miller plus the wheat, which is still nothing but the bread. So the bread counts itself in a variety of ways, and nothing more than itself. If we want to count the true gross product, we have to count in addition to the bread, the flour, and the wheat, and similarly for all other products. Now, this approach is very, very relevant to the next major subject, aggregate spending. We need to start off by asking, what is bought when it is bought? Because surprisingly, there are enormous confusions about this. Most economists and most of the general public believe that when you buy something, you're actually buying more than you buy, that you're buying whatever contributed to the production of what you buy. In point A here, I make the statement, the buyers of goods, consumers' goods, do not buy the means of producing the goods they buy, nor do they buy the means of producing similar goods in the future, nor the products that may be produced from such goods. And to illustrate this, which I immediately do in the next point, B, e.g., the buyer of a loaf of bread does not buy flour when he buys bread. He does not buy wheat when he buys bread. He does not pay the wages of the bakers or the millers or the farmers' helpers. When he buys bread, all that he's buying is the bread, period, nothing else. We in our minds know that the bread derives from the flour in turn derives from the wheat, and unfortunately, in many, many cases, the possession of this knowledge leads people to trip over their own knowledge, in effect. They know that there's a connection, and because there's a connection, they think that the bread somehow still represents the flour and the wheat, and that when you buy the bread in some way, you're buying the flour and the wheat, paying the wages all up and down the line, and everything else. Yes, Mr. Castillo.
Does there seem to be, or are there more in the U.S., more in your mind, contemporary economists versus classical economists, and, you know, specifically in the ways that they're thinking? Or is it kind of equal?
No, it's overwhelmingly this way. Overwhelmingly, the contemporary economists and the great mass of the public also believes that when you're buying the final product, such as bread, you're buying the whole banana. You're buying everything. The most famous economist who denied this was an outstanding 19th century economist named John Stuart Mill, whom I hope most of you have heard of in some connection or other. And he advanced a famous proposition called the demand for commodities is not the demand for labor, arguing that when you buy commodities, the produce of labor, you're not buying the labor which produced the commodities, you're just buying the commodities. And that represents the essential point. When you buy the bread, you are not paying the wages of the bakers or millers, you're not buying the flour, you're buying only what you buy, only what you receive in exchange from the seller, and that's it. Now, Mill made the statement that this is a proposition that needs all the illustration it can receive, that the demand for commodities is not demand for labor. And I certainly agree with that, and I intend to supply, and in my book have supplied, a great deal of illustration of this fact. But I want to flesh out the implications a little bit. The fact that bread comes from flour, which comes from wheat, and the fact that the seller of the bread will almost certainly use the money he takes in the sale of bread to buy a replacement supply of flour, and the seller of the flour will buy a replacement supply of wheat. This does not mean that when you buy the bread or the flour, you're buying anything but the bread or the flour. See, there are different connections in production, in spending, and all the possible confusions are made. It's like a Murphy's Law of confusion. If it can go wrong, it will go wrong. If there's a way to confuse things, the confusion takes place. That's the way it seems to be. Yes, Mr. Wilson.
Would you consider the connection between them, though, to be a percentage?
Pardon me?
Would the connection between them possibly be like a percentage? Maybe it's not the whole thing. You're not getting the whole of everything. You're getting a fraction of it.
Well, there is a connection. There is a connection. But when you buy the one, you're not buying any of the other. When you buy a loaf of bread, you're not buying half the flour that made it, or a tenth of the flour that made it. You're not buying any of the flour that made it. You're just buying the bread. Now, yes, Mr. Mr. Taylor, excuse me.
Yes, I know last week you talked about the fact that this impacts the gross national product figures.
Yeah.
But in what other way does this fallacy type thinking negatively impact, you know, the market?
Well, it negatively impacts our ability to understand the economic system. And that'll be one of the next major subjects when we get into the process of capital accumulation. See, if you think the only thing being produced is consumers' goods and the only thing being purchased is consumers' goods, then you're not seeing capital goods. You're not seeing the fact that capital goods are produced. You're not seeing the fact that anything which makes possible a greater ability to produce in general will also promote the production of capital goods, that capital goods are favored by anything that favors production in general. Now, typically it's thought that when production is favored, all that means is that we can have more consumers' goods. It's not seen as a source of capital accumulation. Mm-hmm. The role of saving in the economy is grossly understated. The role of productive expenditure is ignored. And we'll see quite a few things that derive from this. Yes, Mr. Foster.
You know, I'm one of the people who have tripped over my own knowledge.
Okay.
I can't help but to think that there are times where you do purchase more than what you're actually going to get. When you use bread as an example, I can follow your logic because there's no real substitute for bread. But if I look at an American car versus a foreign car. Mm-hmm. If I choose to spend my money over here, I may be all patriotic. You know, I'm purchasing this car because I truly believe that it's gonna help employ American citizens. Or if I buy a luxury car versus an economic car, I'm buying it because it has leather seats, because it has all the bells and whistles.
Yeah, okay.
You know, so can you help me get over that?
Okay, when you buy something that's domestically produced, it's true that people will be employed in the production of that item, but that doesn't mean they won't be employed. They'll be employed in producing something that's exported, or they'll be employed in producing things that represent investment, which is financed by foreign exchange. See, just think, how much of the things that we buy are produced in the state of California or within Orange County? Very, very little. So, do you think that in order to promote employment in California and Orange County, we should be buying very locally? Is that what employment depends on? What would be the effect if we insisted that people buy California produced? And I think we see occasionally. Pardon me?
Avocados,
California.
Cheese.
Cheese, avocados, almonds. Okay. Now, if we boycotted the out-of-state products, do you think really that we need to buy these things to promote employment in California? What would be the net effect of, let's say we would have laws requiring that Californians only buy California cheese, etc.
Prices would go up.
I mean, prices would probably be higher, and your range of choice would be much narrower. And the result would be we wouldn't have any greater employment. We just have a poorer variety of products, a lesser array of products. Yes, Mr. Richards.
Back probably about 10 years ago in Spain, you could only buy a car called a Seat, and it was a Spanish version of a Fiat. And the Japanese, they would build their cars in England, try and get them into Spain, mm-hmm. but you could only buy it if you bought it in England, drove it down. The Spanish government wouldn't allow any other yeah. car but the Seat car.
And policies like that help yeah. to explain why Spain had one of the lowest standards yeah. of living in Western Europe.
Exactly. Now it's changed. Now it's different.
Probably
now
like the slogan they'll be using.
By me? like the what?
Probably not the marketing slogan they'll be going after.
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Wright?
I was just going to say, in looking at it from the point of view of, okay, I'm the patriot buying the American-made car. Yeah. Sure, it may be assembled in America, but 90% of those parts are probably manufactured in Japan. So if you're really patriotic, you would have to search out that automobile that was built solely in the United States, which probably doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And anyway, just as a...
You're not buying
everything separately. You're buying it as a car as a whole, so you're not buying... This is just to help me clarify. You're not buying the catalytic converter and all these things as pieces. You're buying the individual car, which then, whether it's made in America or not, is by extension also supporting...
Okay, well, the very fact that you would recognize that while the car might be assembled in the United States, that doesn't make the parts be produced in the United States. They're still produced... They are separate and distinct. And so this would go along with the point I'm trying to make, that each thing is something separate and distinct. Now, it's true that when you buy the car, a luxury car, one of the things that may appeal to you is that the upholstery is leather, and that's perceptible. So you could say, well, I identify the leather seats in the car, so I am buying a car, one of whose characteristics is that it has leather seats, or it has... An extra good sound system or whatever. So these things are perceptible parts of what you're buying, just as when you buy a loaf of bread, you could say, well, I like this particular bread because I especially like the crust that's on it, something like that. Okay. Yes, Ms. Yang.
I'm a little bit confused here. From last week's lecture, you're saying that aggregate production include all the immediate goods as
yeah.
consumed within the production.
Yeah.
But now we're talking about when we buy a loaf of bread, it's just to focus on the loaf of bread itself and not to account for...
Well, when we buy the bread, we're buying the bread, but we need to focus on the economy as a whole and recognize that there also are separate, distinct purchases of wheat and flour that are not counted in the bread. The point is, if we want to embrace the totality of spending in the economy, we would need to think of the spending for bread, plus the spending for wheat, plus the spending for flour, plus the meeting of the payrolls. That would be a true account of total spending along those lines. We do a grossly inadequate job of conceiving total spending if we limit ourselves to the expenditure for the bread. If we think that when we've counted the bread, we've somehow counted all of these other things. My point is that we have not counted any of these other things in the mere act of counting the bread. So we need to go out and count them, and a true measure of total spending would include the spending at all of these different stages. Now, as I say, people make confusions. They think because the bread comes from flour, somehow you're buying the flour when you buy the bread. They think that because the seller of the bread, or at least the baker of the bread, will probably use the money he takes in to buy fresh flour, they think, well, in that along those lines too, when you buy the bread, you're somehow buying the flour. And then a further confusion would be the fact that when the bread is purchased, the purchaser may make sandwiches out of it, or may make toast. Sometimes you'll hear people talking as though when you buy the bread, you're buying a loaf of toast or a quantity of sandwiches. They're confusing it with something further down rather than further back. Yes, Ms. Foley.
So when the government reports GDP figures being up or down, they're really only counting finished goods?
Essentially, yes, the final product. There is one significant exception. They count true gross expenditure on new plant and equipment. What they call gross investment is gross expenditure for plant and equipment, but the net change in inventories. So GDP counts private and government consumption and what is called gross investment, which is gross as far as it's for plant and equipment spending, but net for on account of inventories.
What about things like home refinancing. There's a lot of that going on, people getting new loans and stuff. Yeah. And I had read that that was being considered part of GDP, and it had accounted for a large increase in GDP because there was so much financial activity going on.
Well, the financial activity could enter in, like, for example, the loan origination fees of financial institutions or anything along those lines, the interest income of the financial institutions, that would be counted, but not the gross amounts of financing. So if you take out a $200,000 loan, that $200,000 does not enter into GDP, nor should it, but what would enter in would be any fees to the real estate brokers, things of that kind. Now, I want to demonstrate in a variety of different ways that this notion that when you buy the consumer's good, you're buying anything more, why that is simply wrong. Let's contrast.
Hello.
Okay. Let's contrast the purchase of simply a loaf of bread that many people think represents more than itself. Let's contrast that with a real purchase of bread, flour, and wheat. And let me tell you how I would understand a real purchase of bread, flour, and wheat. Imagine you're in the supermarket, you have a shopping cart, you go down to the baked goods aisle, you reach up, you put a loaf of bread in your cart. That's one act. You go to another aisle, you find a bag of flour. You put that in the cart alongside the loaf of bread. And let's imagine that there is a real health food nut section in this supermarket. So they're selling wheat stalks somewhere. And you buy a set of wheat stalks. Now you've got three items in your cart. You go up to the checkout stand, and the cashier rings up one item after the other, the three different items. I would say, this is a genuine purchase of bread, flour, and wheat. You've got three distinct items. You've bought these three things. Now, if all that you have in your shopping cart is the loaf of bread, that is only the purchase of a loaf of bread. The idea that in any sense, in merely buying the loaf of bread, you're buying the flour and the wheat as well. The flour and the wheat are shadows in your mind, in effect. They are not actual entities. You're confusing the contents of your consciousness with what's out there. Now, just think about this. Just think what an incredible bargain it would be if somehow for the price of the bread, you were also getting the wheat and the flour. You're getting three things in one package. And best of all, how many calories are you consuming? You're only consuming the calories of the bread, not that plus the flour and the wheat, right? Now further, I make a reference in point B to amazing digestive powers. What do you think it would be like really to eat flour?
Dry.
Imagine you could stick a teaspoon in a bag of flour, put it in your mouth, swallow it, then I would say, you're really eating flour. But when you take a bite of a piece of bread, you're not eating flour, you're just eating the bread. And imagine that you bought a loaf of bread and somehow there were flour somewhere, you'd be pretty damn mad. And if you bit down on some unmilled wheat, you'd be angrier still. And if that's not enough, try chewing on tractor parts. all you have is the bread. That's it. You don't buy these other things any more than you're eating them when you eat the bread. You don't buy them when you buy the bread. You don't eat them when you eat the bread. Yes, Mr. Mendez?
Question then, with bread where everything gets together and you can't really take it apart, it makes sense. What about if someone purchases something, let's say like a car which is made of parts that could be taken apart, like the tires would come back off and behind it, and so forth. But I mean, do you recount, let's say you do take the tires off and sell that separately. Sometimes cars are worth more in parts than they are as a whole. Does that go towards the GDP again, or is that something that...
Well, no, I would say what should be counted in GDP, in the total spending, when you buy the car, you're buying the car. You're buying the totality of everything that's part of the car. So when you buy the car, you're getting the car with the tires, with the upholstery, the whole works. That's one purchase. You're getting the whole entity. That's the car. But then I would say the automobile company, if the automobile company has bought the tires, that's a separate expenditure. And that's the sales revenue of the tire company. And that should be counted in a measure of gross spending. Yes, Mr. Wright.
Again, to help me clarify, yeah. Let's say I buy a car and get in a car accident.
Yeah.
I then am able to sell that car at some salvage. Oh, I get reimbursed by my insurance company. Mm-hmm. That car is then taken to a salvager, and then he also has a chance to sell the car off in parts, as Mark's saying. Now, I guess there's a work in that sense that I paid for it, then the insurance company paid for it, and then there was still a profit to be made off it after that.
Okay,
or is there a loss because the insurance company is going to have to raise premiums in order to offset that?
The insurance company's payment to you is not a purchase. The insurance company is reimbursing you for your loss. The insurance company is reimbursing you for your loss. Now, when the car goes to a junkyard and the junkyard is selling parts as scrap, I would say that's part of sales revenues, but it's not something newly produced. It's not newly produced, but there could be a way to make an allowance for it. I don't know if the GDP would be the precise place to do it, but these are sales revenues of the secondhand dealers, and that should be counted somewhere. Yes?
I think that's what you're just... So, like, the used car dealership, that would go towards the GDP. Is that correct?
Would the sales...
Used vehicles, does it have to be new?
Well, the GDP is supposed to refer to newly produced goods and services. But I would have no objection to counting the revenues of the sellers of used products. That could be done too. But that's not a measure of new production. But they shouldn't be ignored. It's something that exists. Yes, Ms. Nicolova.
Okay, how about when we have a computer, for example, and we buy a motherboard from somewhere, and we buy all the parts, which is counted towards the GDP, and then we make the computer and we sell it.
Okay.
For a bigger amount.
Yeah.
Isn't that counted twice?
No, there are expenditures for the different components, and then there's an expenditure to buy the product. It's no more counting twice than counting the flour and the bread. Here we have a computer as the product, the motherboard and the hard drive or whatever, those are the inputs, instead of bread and flour.
So just like the diagram we had last week.
It's essentially the same point. Yeah, if we want to measure what is the total sales revenues going on in the economy, if we wanted to know that, it's not enough to count just the receipts of the computer makers. You'd also have to count the revenues of the board makers, the hard drive makers who are selling to the computer manufacturers, the same as the flour millers and the wheat farmers. Yes, Mr. Taylor.
I think I have one of those stupid questions that you said.
Okay.
There's no question that's stupid.
Okay.
I'm getting slightly confused.
Yeah.
I was sold on the point that when you buy a loaf of bread,
yeah,
you're just buying bread. You're not buying all of the content that make it up.
Yeah.
But yet, we're talking now, and we're saying that we need to consider the various components from a sales revenue perspective.
Yeah, we need to consider them. Okay, I don't mean to cut you off.
Maybe you understand where I'm going. I'm trying to understand where we're resting.
I think you're raising essentially the same question that Ms. Yang asked a few minutes ago. What I'm saying is that when we look at the final product, that's all we're looking at.
Right.
But in order to have a gross concept, we then need to look at, in addition, the other things. We need to look at the flour and the wheat. We need to look at the hard drives and the motherboards. So, you see, the problem that exists is that people think when they've looked at the final product, merely in doing that, they've somehow looked at everything, and therefore don't need to look at anything else. And if they do look at something else, they think it's the error of double counting. And I'm saying when we look at the final product, that is all we're looking at. We haven't counted anything else when we've done that, but we need to count everything, and therefore we have to go and count everything.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Wilson.
To summarize, looking at GDP, what you're saying is we're looking at products that are produced, that are newly produced and sold.
That what?
That were newly produced,
yeah,
right, and sold. You said newly produced goods and services, is what you said, stated.
Yeah, that's what they want to take into account, yeah.
So when we're looking at GDP, we're looking at, the hard drive was manufactured and produced, mm-hmm. that's one item. The motherboard was manufactured and produced, that's one item. Mm-hmm. Computer was manufactured and produced, that's also one single item. So in the case of GDP, we should consider all those things because each one of those is by itself its own piece, correct?
Yeah, in a proper measure of GDP. The way it's actually done is they would just consider the computers insofar as they're sold to final buyers.
So in practice, right, in today's world practice, GDP is only being looked at the computer level.
At the final product level, yeah.
So the argument is saying that truly today we're doing it falsely, we're doing it incorrectly. We should be looking at each one of those items as being a newly produced good or service. Mm-hmm. That went to market.
Yeah.
Correct?
A newly produced good and service what?
That went to market.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Okay, so that a decent summation?
Yeah, we should be looking at everything. We should be looking at all the totality of sales revenues and incomes. That's what we should be looking at. That would take into account the total of spending.
Right.
Yes.
You just lost control.
Okay, all right, okay.
But what is the difference between saying we need to count the motherboard, the hard drive, the memory, and the monitor, and saying, but we don't count the wheat and the flour?
Well, we do. We should.
Okay.
See, what I'm saying is we don't count it when we count the bread. When we count the bread, that's all that we counted. We should be counting the wheat and the flour. We haven't counted them when we count the bread. Therefore, we need to go out and count them.
Okay. You lost me on that. I understand it now. Okay, you're saying it should be included.
Yeah, it should be included.
In the computation of GDP, not the thought of what we're buying.
It should be included in the computation of GDP, but it is thought mistakenly that it is included merely in counting the final product.
Okay, now I get it.
The final product, I'm trying to show, counts nothing but itself.
Right.
But we should be counting everything. Yeah. Gross means
now,
gross.
Now
gross I means everything. And
now,
to
now.
Okay.
Light bulb went out.
Okay. Yes.
I offer this illustration. When I look at trying to figure out what is GDP, it's what do I walk out of the door with. I don't walk out of the door with the wheat or the flour. I walk out of the door with the bread.
Right.
My assumption is that somebody else has counted that flour that they walked into their door with to manufacture that bread. And it's just like in a car. I walk out of the door with a car. I don't walk out of the door with an alternator and an engine and wheels, tires, and steering wheel. I walk out with a car.
Okay, that's what you bought. They bought the car. Right. And now other people have walked out door with those other things.
Yes.
And we should be counting everything. But what is done is they count, in effect, just the car, thinking that the car represents somehow the purchase of the steel and the iron ore and everything else up and down the line.
And I guess I'm simple because I don't look at that.
Okay, but that's how they're looking at it. Yes, Mr. Woody.
So in that context, what you're talking about, the people that want to look at just the final product, in thinking that it's just the final product, not all the other products, is that where they're getting where they think you're double counting?
They think that when you count the final product, you've somehow counted everything. And so if you then go out and in addition to the final product count the other things, then they say you're double counting.
Okay, that's where that term applies then.
Okay, they say it's double counting because they believe mistakenly that you've already counted them when you count the final product. But the final product counts only itself. Mr. Whitesides.
I had a question because last week we talked about the government as a consumer, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, other economics classes, that are Keynesian economist or whatever, classical, whatever.
Yeah.
Not as good as you.
Okay, all right, goes without saying. Yeah, all right. All right.
They say something like this, E plus C plus G, right, plus I minus E, right?
What is B?
GDP.
What is B?
Businesses plus consumers plus government plus.
They don't have business. They don't have businesses.
All right.
They have consumption, government spending, investment, and then if you want to be fully complete, net exports.
Okay. So, you know, something along these lines. But last week, we talked about how G and C are the same thing.
Yeah, G is a subcategory of C.
Oh, okay, so we'll put a little G down here.
G, see, you can show G separately, but it is still consumption. Because when the government makes its expenditures, are they making the expenditures for the purpose of making subsequent sales? No, they're not. And so the money they spend is used up and gone. And the fact that it is consumption is confirmed by what experience we all have throughout the year. Especially on the 15th of certain months, April 15th being the most important. We have to pay taxes. Well, why do we have to pay taxes?
So the G can spend in the economy.
Because the government, to enable the government to go on consuming. You see, if the government weren't consuming, if it were set up as a business enterprise, which it cannot be, but in a business enterprise, business firms are spending money, but do they constantly have to go to raise fresh money outside? Sometimes they do, but basically, where do business firms get the money to repeat their, to continue their activities? Out of their sales revenues. They have sales revenues. The sales revenues, if they exceed the costs, the sales revenues will enable the firms to replace everything they've used up, and to the extent there's a profit, to more than replace. That gives the firms the means of expanding on the basis of reinvested profits. A consumer is not in that position. A consumer, including the government, is constantly using up the funds and constantly having to turn to some outside source of funds. In the case of the government, the taxpayers, or to some extent, the printing press. But the government does not sustain itself, and the best proof is that it constantly needs tax revenue.
So it's best to leave it as a subcategory, not as a full category here.
You can leave it as capital G if you like, but recognize that government spending is consumption. It's a separate category. You could think of it as public consumption as opposed to private consumption. But it is consumption. That's the important thing.
Okay. I just wanted to see if there was a discrepancy between, you know, your superior economics compared to what other economists have thought of.
All right. Government is a consumer. That's, I think, the significant point here. Now, just a further elaboration. The fact that one thing comes from another, that's what leads so many people to think that in some sense, that thing is still present, that the bread comes from the flour. Therefore, the flour, in some sense, is still in the bread. Well, we've pretty much seen that that's not true. If you ever ate the flour, you'd be coughing your head off for quite a while. But take another illustration. You can start with ice, and you can melt the ice into water, and then you could boil the water into steam. And this particular steam is coming from what was ice. Does that mean that the ice is in the steam?
No.
No, it doesn't. And no more is the flour in the bread. The flour is used up and gone as the means of getting the bread. Yes, Mr. Taylor.
So thinking about practical applications from a business perspective, what would be the implication if this theory was adopted? That, you know, it seems to me that we've developed the thought that GDP is understated in terms of the amount, you know, of spending. So what would be the impact if, in fact, this was reversed and now everyone's on board with counting?
Right, the impact would be to recognize that the main type of spending in the economy is not consumption, but productive expenditure. That productive expenditure depends on saving. That most of the spending that takes place in the economy takes place on a foundation of saving. This would put saving in a vastly better light than it is now. Today, people more often than not tend to confuse saving with hoarding. And if you think that saving essentially means hoarding, then as far as government policy is concerned, what do you think will be the likely impact of government policy on saving compared with what it would be if we had a better view of saving? Do you think the government will be out to promote? Pardon me?
Government would set forth further benefits for saving as opposed to the reverse.
Right. If the government perceived major benefits in saving, if they didn't think of saving as representing essentially hoarding, but as fueling the economic system, what implications would that have for such things as tax policy?
It would alter tax policy.
Mm-hmm. Tax policy would be very profoundly affected, right?
Yeah.
You would not have taxes that discourage saving in any way. You try to put the tax burden as far as possible on consumption rather than saving. Today it's thought you can have taxes, doesn't matter how much they impact saving. And we have all kinds of taxes that heavily impact saving, and I'll name just a few. The inheritance tax, the corporate income tax, the upper brackets of the personal income tax, the capital gains tax. These are all taxes that are paid very heavily at the expense of what otherwise would have been saved.
How is that? I get that. I wish that happened. I wish that would occur.
Yeah.
But I could see where, in your example, that the view would be that the tax on each of those is on income, generation of income on capital gains, generation of income on corporate profits, as opposed to saving. How do you develop that further? It sounds to me like your example is the taxation is on income as opposed to saving.
Well, the tax is on income, but that's one step removed from being on saving. Was just ask yourself, what would corporations be doing, for example, if somehow the corporate income tax could be abolished? Imagine government spending were cut sufficiently equivalent to the corporate income tax proceeds, and then the corporate income tax were abolished. Now, what do you think most corporations would be doing with most of the funds that they had previously had to pay over in taxes?
Reinvest.
They would be saving and reinvesting. That's what they would be doing. Now, even to the extent that they paid dividends with those funds, what would the higher income dividend recipients be doing with a huge chunk of the dividends?
They'd be reinvesting.
They'd be saving and reinvesting. And so the reduction of the corporate income tax, the reduction in government spending and the corporate income tax would mean a significant increase in the volume of saving in the economy. Now, in the way Keynesians look at this, if something increases saving, they think that saving is essentially hoarding, and they describe it as a leakage. If you had a previous macroeconomics course, maybe you remember the expression leakage, that's used as a synonym for saving. They think that saving just disappears into non-spending. They think that essentially the only spending is consumption. That's their basic view of spending. Yes, Mr. Wilson.
Was it Hazard's point on that, the fact that the banks would be reinvesting those funds?
Yeah.
So it would be going back out. So
yes, that's true. That what is saved is spent. It's invested. But on the Keynesian view, what is saved is hoarded. Yes, Mr. Wright.
I set this forth to a finance teacher here. He said, look, if people are saving, and banks are willing to lend, what's the incentive for companies to borrow if nobody's buying their products? Why are they going to borrow? They're going to have lower, people are going to be buying less, which means their cash flow is going to be down. Why are they going to go and borrow in order to try, they're going to think, no, we've got to play it safe. He absolutely, because, anyway, saying what I had learned here, he said, absolutely not. That's absolutely contrary.
Okay. All right. I'm glad you raised this question. Mr. Wright is asking, why would companies spend money if their sales are down? And you're thinking that sales mean simply consumer sales. Now, there are times when you have a financial contraction, when people, suddenly, particularly business firms, find it necessary to increase their cash holdings. Now, when this happens, incidentally, how is this viewed? What are the firms, what's allegedly going on that's causing the contraction of spending? Well, that certainly enters in, but as between people consuming and saving, what would they say is happening?
Recession.
But, well, what is supposed to be the relationship between saving and recession in terms of cause and effect?
Not as much money in the marketplace.
But what happens if people want to save more all of a sudden and they'll consume less? How is that interpreted in terms of the overall total volume of spending? Then it goes down. It's thought that saving is negative for spending. That saving is negative for spending. And this goes along with the idea that saving is in some real sense just hoarding. Now, in reality, yes, you have a comment, Mr. Richards?
Real quick, are there many government economists that agree with you, or are most of them on the other side?
I would say they're overwhelmingly on the other side.
Okay, so there's never, even the Republicans wouldn't appoint somebody as one of their advisors? That
there might be some, but I would say the views that I'm propounding, if you want to identify them in terms of schools of thought, there's a school of economics called the Austrian School, and it has essentially the same type of views. And the older British classical economists had the same views. Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, and the others.
Are there any governments in the world that have those views today?
No, they would all be essentially like ours, or worse. Now, this is a very good application. You see, if one thinks that consumption and spending are one and the same thing, then it appears that you have a serious problem. What happens if people decide to consume less and save more? Let's suppose that people change their habits. They decided they needed to make greater provision for the future. They wanted to consume less for some time and save and invest more. Now, in the eyes of most people, this creates a kind of paradox, something really bad. Because what does it appear that would have to go on? It seems like sales revenues would fall.
Prices would be down.
Sales revenues would fall, and at the same time, you'd be asking business firms to spend more against lower sales revenues. Do you see this problem?
Yes.
Well, the belief that that is what would happen rests on the assumption that the demand for capital goods does not exist, that the demand for capital goods exists only as a charge against the demand for consumers' goods. It's not seen that the demand for capital goods itself represents sales revenues. And let's try to work this with numbers. In the real world economy today, even today's understated GDP is $12 trillion. That's an awful lot of zeros. And it uses up a lot of brain space. You know, our brains, I think, have something in common with the cache in a computer. We want to try to minimize any waste of brain space. So instead of thinking of the economy in terms of trillions with all those zeros, let's just assume that total spending in the entire economy will be 1,000 units of money. Each unit can represent many tens or hundreds of billions of dollars, but this way we only have three zeros to work with instead of 12 or however many. So let's imagine the entire spending in the whole economy is 1,000 units of money. That represents total business sales revenues. Just 1,000 units of money is the total business sales revenues. Now, you could have different possible outcomes here. In one outcome, maybe the entire 1,000 of sales revenues comes from the sale of consumers' goods. People are consuming 1,000 units of money, and whoever is selling consumers' goods, they have 1,000 units of sales revenues. But here there is zero demand for capital goods. There would be no demand for capital goods, only a demand for consumers' goods. All right, now, suppose the sellers who are taking in the 1,000 of sales revenues, suppose they decide they no longer want to consume their entire revenues, they want to save 100. So now, and they'll buy capital goods with this 100. All right, what are total sales revenues in the economy now? Pardon me?
900.
Oh, yeah, I hear 900. I hear 1,000. All right, Mr. Wright says there's still 1,000. Mr. Barton says they're 900. Do you want to explain why you think they're 1,000?
It's not a lot, or it's no less spending because they're buying capital goods.
Yeah.
Because there's 100 of spending for capital goods, right? There's 900 of spending for consumers' goods, but alongside that, there's 100 of spending for capital goods. So what are total sales revenues?
$1,000.
Still $1,000. And the $100 that's expended for capital goods, some of this will be expended by producers of consumers' goods, a small part is expended by producers of capital goods. Think of it this way. The economy functions, we'll imagine, in yearly cycles. So this $1,000 of spending is the total annual spending. There's $1,000 being spent this year. There'll be a fresh $1,000 spent next year, and a third $1,000 the year after that, and on and on. Now, this year, there's $900 of consumption taking place. There's also $100 of spending for capital goods. And this $100 of spending for capital goods is made in anticipation of what sales coming in next year. How much sales are expected to come in next year? $1,000. Altogether, $1,000. Next year, there'll be $900 of spending for consumers' goods, $100 of spending for capital goods. Now, this $100 that's spent this year for capital goods, if there's going to be $900 next year of sales of consumers' goods, $100 sales of capital goods, how would you expect today's $100 of expenditure for capital goods to be allocated as between the production of consumers' goods for next year and capital goods for next year?
Well, the forecast is the same as your answer.
Well, we have $100, and would you expect, what kind of quantitative breakdown could we reasonably expect?
9 to 1.
It would be reasonable if out of this 100, 90 was expended to produce next year's consumers' goods worth 900, and 10 was expended to produce next year's capital goods worth 100, right? Okay. Now, would it be possible, do you think, to reach the point where we have 500 expended to buy capital goods and only 500 expended to buy consumers' goods? Would this mean that business would have to operate at a zero profit because it would take in 500 and its capital goods would cost it 500?
No.
What would sales revenues still be?
$1,000.
They'd still be $1,000, only now, how would the sales revenues break down?
50-50.
Yeah. Pardon me? 50-50. There'd be 500 of demand for capital goods and 500 of demand for consumers' goods. How would the 500 of demand for capital goods in a given year tend to break down as between the production of capital goods for the next year and the production of consumers' goods for the next year?
How would that 50%?
1 to 1. Yeah, 1 to 1. So there's 500 being spent to buy capital goods this year to produce a total product of next year that's worth 1,000. But to what extent would there be a demand for capital goods to produce specifically consumers' goods for next year? And to what extent would the demand for capital goods be to produce specifically capital goods for next year?
Still
50-50. 50-50, yes?
It's still the 500.
Well, the total's 500, but we would have, it'd be 250 of demand for capital goods to produce next year's 500 worth of consumers' goods, and 250 of demand for capital goods to produce next year's 500 worth of capital goods, right? Now, could we go further? Could we reach the point where the demand for capital goods is greater than the demand for consumers' goods and business still operates at a positive profit?
Yes.
Could we have 600 of demand for capital goods and only 400 of demand for consumers' goods?
Yes. Just allocation of money.
The allocation would be different. We'd have 400 receipts from consumers' goods to be expected next year, 600 receipts from capital goods next year. And this year, the 600 of demand for capital goods would be broken up how? 60-40. So capital goods used to produce next year's consumers' goods, that would be 40% of the 600, that would be 240. 60% of the 600, or 360, that would be used to produce the capital goods. Now, ultimately, if we allow for time to go by, all of the capital goods are ultimately serving in the production of consumers' goods, but it will take a longer time. And let's see how this works. I'll go back to the 50-50 breakdown because the arithmetic is a little easier. Here we are. We have 500 demand for consumers' goods. What is the demand for capital goods to produce that 500 worth of consumers' goods?
250.
What's the demand for the capital goods to produce that 250 worth of capital goods? What's the demand for the capital goods to produce 250 worth of capital goods? You see, we're breaking down the capital goods now. Pardon me?
Are we cutting everything
down? 125. You see, here we are. In total, when we have everything taken together, we have 250 of capital goods is devoted to producing 500 worth of consumers' goods. Another 250 worth of capital goods is devoted to producing 500 worth of capital goods. But if we look at those capital goods that will appear next year, what's going to be done with them? Well, 250 of them will be used to produce the consumers' goods of the year after next. And so how much of the capital goods today will be devoted to producing those capital goods? Well, 125. 125 today will produce 250 of capital goods for next year, which will be producing 500 of consumers' goods the year after that. Now, this 125 of capital goods today that's devoted to capital goods, that's still going to consumers' goods, but 2 years later. Not next year, but 2 years later. And then we could carry this further. There's 6250 devoted to producing next year's 125 of capital goods that the year after that will produce 250 that the year beyond that will produce 500. So ultimately, everything is still going to the production of consumers' goods, but it takes a longer span of time. This is known, in Austrian economics, as a longer, more roundabout process of production, a longer period of production. To the extent that people are engaged in saving and investing rather than consuming, the economy is able to concentrate more heavily on time-consuming processes of production. Our primitive ancestors were engaged in hand-to-mouth production. People would be wandering through the forest. If they saw fruit growing on a tree branch, they'd yank it off and eat it, or they'd gather nuts. This is the shortest possible type of production. It's producing without capital. But as civilization develops, as people advance, the processes of production become longer, more roundabout. Instead of producing just the consumer's goods, people start producing tools. And then when they have the tools, they can produce more consumer's goods. And then they're producing tools to make the better tools and materials to make the tools, and on and on. And to the extent that an economy saves more, it is in a position to undertake longer, more roundabout, and also more productive processes of production.
So you're saying saving, the act of saving, goes towards the production expenditures that go on to lead to the consumption.
Yeah. Okay. And now we can have, it's perfectly possible, we have different conditions in an economy. In one economy, you could have 900 of demand for consumers' goods, only 100 of demand for capital goods. In a much more advanced economy, you could have 400 of demand for consumers' goods and 600 of demand for capital goods. Conceivably, we could have an economy with 100 of demand for consumers' goods and 900 of demand for capital goods. In such an economy, would there be a shortage of sales revenues? No, there would not. There would be less consumer sales revenues, but there'd be more sales revenues from the production of capital goods. And the capital goods, the whole process could still be profitable, because after all, what is the total of sales revenues? It's still 1,000, and the demand for capital goods is still less than that. It's just greater than the limited part of sales revenues that reflects consumption. But you see, if you think that the only spending is consumer spending, then you have to think that if people decided to save, they're in a paradoxical loss-making position. You see, if you think the only spending is for consumption, and you're thinking, well, my God, if people save, what happens to business sales revenues? It goes down. And how are businesses supposed to spend more while they're taking in less? Well, they're not taking in less. They're taking in less from the sale of consumers' goods, more from the sale of capital goods. So this is one of the significant results of being able to see that the buying of capital goods is actual buying, that it's a source of sales revenues, that consumption does not represent the totality of spending. Yes, Mr. Wilson. I'm sorry, Mr. Chung, who hasn't asked a question.
I understand the entire concept that you just talked about.
Yeah.
However, though, is that how could you say, or maybe I'm missing something here, is that how could you say it's good from an individual company standpoint for the individual company, the economic health for the individual company, say, for instance, if GM, a car manufacturer, spend, you know, 60% of their expenditure on capital goods to produce consumer goods,
yeah,
then on their accounting ledger or something, the outflow of money versus the inflow of money is not balancing. And so how would that be still good for an individual company?
Okay.
I mean, maybe good for the economy as a whole.
Okay. All right, you're asking if there's a drop in demand for consumers' goods, mightn't this be bad for individual companies? Well, it could be, but let's take the example of GM, and let's suppose in the economy as a whole, people decided to consume less and save more, and part of this retrenchment in consumption meant they would spend less in buying automobiles. Okay, but if they want to save and invest more, what will this imply about expenditure for such things as heavy trucks, construction equipment, diesel locomotives? Those things would increase, and GM, as a matter of fact, makes such things too. So in a case of this kind, one division or set of divisions of GM would have lower sales, another would have higher sales. But let's suppose we have a company that's entirely in producing consumers' goods. Okay, then its revenues and profits go down. But what happens to the revenues and profits of other companies that are entirely producing capital goods? They go up. So it's no different, really, than any change in demand of any kind. What happens if people decide they want less donuts and more Pop-Tarts? Okay, that's bad business for the donut producers, but good for the Pop-Tart makers. So anytime there's a change in the pattern of demand, those firms that have not adjusted their investments properly, they'll lose. But those who are in the area where the demand is increasing, in this case the capital goods producers, they'd gain. Yes, Mr. Castillo.
Back to the scenario when you said that the capital goods were less because more people wanted to save this capital good to be up. What if the scenario had been if the capital good market was down because people in other countries weren't buying our exports, okay, thus wanting to save in their own country and investing in their own capital market? Would that then hurt this economy?
You're asking, what if people in other countries don't want to buy our exports? That's a separate issue. I mean, that really doesn't have any direct connection with the issue of capital goods. Suppose you could raise the same question. Suppose people in other countries just don't want to buy our goods.
But want to take the money and reinvest in their capital market, not necessarily our capital market.
Or they want to buy consumers' goods in their own market rather than our market. Okay, we're saying, what if foreign purchasers simply don't want as much of our goods? Okay, other things being equal, that would reduce the demand for our goods, and we'd have, to that extent, a decline.
But then the hope would be if they were due to exports, that the people in other markets were actually reinvesting that saving dollar within our capital market. That would be
say that slower.
The hope would be then if the capital goods were down,
yeah,
because people were saving and investing in capital markets, the hope would be that investing in the capital markets would be in our economy, thus equaling everything out.
Well, so you're tying this, I'm having a little difficulty following.
Maybe I'm saying
it wrong. Okay. You're saying people abroad are saving more.
Wait, because assume there's a lot of import-export going on.
Okay, there's importing-exporting. Okay.
So consumer goods.
Okay. And now people abroad decide to save more.
Correct.
Okay, but for some reason, while they had been buying our consumers' goods, they don't want to invest here. So they're not going to be buying our capital goods or promoting their production. Okay, well, this is just the same thing as, for some reason, the international demand for our products falls. That has nothing specifically to do with the extent to which people save or don't save. You're just postulating a reduction in the global demand for our goods. Okay, now, to the extent that that would happen, there would be a monetary decline in our economy. If we were using a global currency, like gold, if for some reason American products fell into disfavor internationally, then the fraction of the world's money supply that circulated in the United States would be less. Okay. Now, I don't know to what extent this discussion about the demand for capital goods rising at the expense of the demand for consumers' goods falling. I hope that you've been able to follow that. If you have further questions on it, by all means, throw them at me. Let me go a little bit further here along the lines of when you buy a consumer's good, that's all that you're buying. And this next point is why is it that producers need capital if it's the consumers who buy what they buy? For example, suppose you want to get into the automobile business or the steel business. You're going to need a massive amount of capital to do that. Well, why? Why don't you simply tell all your suppliers, look, haven't you guys read Professor Samuelson or gone to an MBA program or whatever? Haven't you learned that it's the consumers who buy everything? So you just send your invoices to the consumers. Well, why can't you do that?
You got to buy the plant. Listen,
you have to have the ability to buy it. It's the business firms that are buying these things. They're paying for them usually far in advance of the time that the consumers will buy from them, if the consumers buy from them at all.
I'm sorry, just so I can follow the rest, would you restate your opening question?
Yeah. Why is it that if it were the case that it's the consumers who buy everything, when the consumers buy automobiles, they're somehow buying the steel and buying the iron ore, et cetera, then why is it that automobile companies and steel companies need capital? Why don't they just tell their suppliers and their workers, you'll be paid by the consumers. They're paying for everything. So, but you need capital because you have to pay them. It's not the consumers. Hopefully, the consumers will reimburse you for the expenditures you've made, but it's you who have to make the expenditures, not the consumers.
Right.
Yes, Ms. Nicolò.
I think a good example of your point of view is Dell Computers, because they don't own anything in the motherboards and components that they assemble in the computers, but when a consumer orders the computer, then they work with their vendors to assemble a computer, and that's when everybody gets paid, is when a consumer pays for it. So they have really low overhead, Dell Computers, and they have been very successful in what they're doing.
Well, I think you'd be raising this point as an opposite point. Okay. All right. Well, I would say even there, let's say Dell only manufactures the computer after it has an order. Let's assume that that's the case. Well, even so, typically, when Dell is advertising, what are they also advertising alongside the cash price?
Customer service.
Product.
The financing. They're advertising financing. They're saying $1,400 or $30 a month or whatever. Now, certainly, everyone who's buying $30 a month, there has to be the vendors are not waiting for $30 a month. And also, by the time the individual pays, Dell probably has to pay its vendors something in advance of the customer paying it. They may book the order when the customer books his order, but it's very possible they'll have to pay before they get paid, and certainly they'll have to be financing available if the customer is going to buy it on time. But let's even assume that Dell didn't sell on time at all, and all of their sales were for cash. Okay, now Dell might then get by with minimal capital, but Dell would have to have capital still to some extent. It has to have capital to construct the facilities where it assembles these computers, right? They might not need capital to finance inventory, but they'd still need capital to finance their structures, their advertising, much of their labor force, I would think. But even if Dell needed minimal capital, what about the vendors to Dell? They have to have the capital. So you still need the capital then at the next stage back. All right, now, yet a further point. This is E. If you buy the inputs, you don't have to buy the output. This notion that somehow when you're buying the bread, you're buying the flour, paying the wages of the bakers, etc., what would be the case if you in fact bought flour, you in fact paid the wages of the bakers, would you then have to buy the bread that resulted?
You'd
already own it. Take another example. Suppose we have someone who employs a housekeeper, and he gives the housekeeper money to go shopping. And then the housekeeper prepares meals and serves her employer. Do you think that when the employer sat down to his dinner, the housekeeper would present him with a check for the meal?
No.
Now, why not?
He already bought the ingredients.
Well, he already bought the ingredients and paid for the labor, so therefore he owns the product and doesn't have to buy it. Well, if in reality you do buy the flour and pay the wages of the bakers, you own the bread and therefore don't have to buy it. If you do buy the bread, the only reason you have to buy the bread is because you have not bought the inputs. The very fact of buying the final product means precisely that you have not bought the inputs, because if you had bought them, you wouldn't have to buy the product, you'd already own it. That seems to resonate.
No argument on that.
Clear.
Okay. Now, it would be helpful, I think, for a moment to look at what John Stuart Mill actually said on this subject, and I'll try to bring him up. Here we are. This is on page 683, and I'd appreciate it very greatly if someone would help me relieve the strain on my own vocal cords and read these passages starting right here. We pass now to a fourth fundamental theorem. Right here.
So read how far?
Well, at least down to this paragraph, the end of this paragraph, and then we'll get someone else for the next paragraph.
We pass now to a fourth fundamental
theorem
respecting capital, which is perhaps oftener overlooked or misconceived than even any of the foregoing, what supports and employs productive labor. There we go. That's a little bad. Is the capital is the see the context of working better now? No, that's all right. What supports and employs productive labor is the capital expended in setting it to work, and not the demand of purchasers for the produce of the labor when completed. Demand for commodities is not demand for labor. The demand for commodities determines in what particular branch of production the labor and capital shall be employed. It determines the direction of the labor, but not the more or less of the labor itself, or of the maintenance or payment of the labor. These depend on the amount of the capital
or other funds directly devoted to the substance and the remuneration of labor.
Okay, thank you very much. And let me illustrate that in terms of the quantitative example we've used. When the demand for consumers' goods was 900 and the demand for capital goods was 100, how was the 100 of capital employed as between consumers' goods and capital goods? Pardon me?
1 to 9.
10 of the capital would be employed in producing the 100 of next year's capital goods, 90 in producing the 900 of the capital goods the year after. Now, this is an illustration of what Mill means by the demand for commodities determines the direction in which the capital is employed. We have 100 of capital, and if the demand for one type of commodity is 900 and the demand for another type is only 100, then 90% of the capital expenditure will go to where the demand for commodities is greater. It's determining the direction, 90-10. But it's not determining the more or less. Notice when we get to 600 demand for capital goods, 400 demand for consumers' goods, we have a reduction in the demand for consumers' goods, a rise in the demand for capital goods. The demand will still determine the direction. 360 of the capital goods will be employed in producing 600 of capital goods for the next year, 240 in producing the 400 of consumers' goods. The direction is still being determined by the relative demands, but not the more or less. The relative demands are not determining whether there's 100 of capital available or 600. That's determined by saving. And that's what Mill has in mind, I think. Let me find someone else to read this next paragraph, starting with this theorem. Yes, Mr. Winchell.
This theorem that to purchase produce is not to employ labor, that the demand for labor is constituted by the wages which precede the production and not by the demand which may exist for the commodities resulting from the production, is a proposition which greatly needs all the illustration it can receive. It is to common apprehension a paradox, and even among political economists of reputation, I can hardly point to any except Mr. Ricardo and M. Say,
Monsieur Say,
kept it constantly and steadily in view. Almost all others occasionally express themselves as if a person who buys commodities, the produce of labor, was an employer of labor, and created a demand for it as really and in the same sense as if he had bought the labor itself directly by the payment of wages. It is no wonder that the political economy advances slowly when such a question as this still remains open at its very threshold. I apprehend that if by demand for labor be meant the demand by which wages are raised or the number of laborers in employment increased, demand for commodities does not constitute demand for labor. I conceive that a person who buys commodities and consumes them himself does no good to the laboring classes, and that it is only by what he abstains from consuming and expends in direct payments to laborers in exchange for labor that he benefits the laboring classes, or adds anything to the amount of their employment.
Okay, thank you very, very much. Now, that's a very, very different view on saving and its connection to employment than what you'll read in the business section of the newspapers. And it derives from the fact that Mill is clear that the demand for a consumer's good is not the demand for labor. I think a better statement of his own basic idea would be simply the proposition, the demand for A is the demand for A. A is A, that's the law of identity. The demand for A is the demand for A. When you buy A, you're not buying the things which produced A, you're not buying the things that the seller of A will buy, you're not buying the things into which A will be made, you're simply and only buying A. The purchase of these other things is a separate, distinct action. And the purchase of the capital goods depends on saving, not consumption. Excuse me here. Now, let's go further and start to develop the profound contrast between saving and hoarding. This view that when you buy the consumer's good, you're buying the whole banana, this is closely connected with the belief that saving is hoarding. And the reason for it is that if you think that consumption expenditure buys everything, well, what is there left for savings to buy? If it's the case that when you buy the automobile, in some way, you're buying the steel, paying for the factory, buying the iron ore, the construction of the iron mines, everything else, then what does what role can saving have in connection with spending? If the demand for the final product is the totality, then it's difficult to see what the role of saving can be, except non-spending. You see, saving does mean abstention from consumption. When you save, you're abstaining from consuming. But if you think that consumption expenditure is essentially the only kind of expenditure, then that means when you don't consume, you just don't spend. It's hard to avoid that conclusion. So I say that this promotes the view that saving is hoarding. The belief that consumption buys everything promotes the view that saving is hoarding. Yes, Ms. Nikolova.
What about when a consumer is saving, for example, saving to buy a house?
Yeah.
You can't afford to buy the house, so you're saving to buy a house. And let's say everybody starts saving to buy a house, then the house market would go down, right?
No. If people are saving to buy houses, they're not taking the savings from the purchase of houses. They're taking the savings from the purchase of other things in order to be able to buy a house. And that very example is something I plan to use a little bit later this evening. The demand for things like houses certainly depends on saving. All right, well, let me try to explain briefly why saving does not mean hoarding, why there's a profound difference. Even though in taking the immense majority of economics courses, reading the financial press nowadays, it would be very difficult to avoid the impression that saving is hoarding, because after all, I think as we've already pointed out, if you were to read in the newspapers that the savings rate has gone up, what would be thought to be the result?
Less spending.
Pardon me?
Less spending.
Less spending. This would be the cause of recession. It's thought that saving simply means non-spending, that saving is hoarding. And the use of the term leakage as a synonym for saving in economics textbooks, that's the same issue. Now, yes, Mr. Wright.
Well, what about the terms consumer confidence and consumer spending, meaning that, you know, when those fall, then we're moving toward a recession?
Okay. Again, it's a similar idea. There are indicators of consumer confidence. And it's thought that if consumer confidence goes down, that's a harbinger of recession or depression. Now, you can have a statistical association. What sort of thing will make consumer confidence go down?
Quality,
economic
reports.
If people start to get worried about their jobs, that will reduce consumer confidence. But what I would say is that a recession does not originate with the consumers. It's not the case that all of a sudden the consumers have been going along happy-go-lucky, and all of a sudden, for no reason, just on a whim, they decide they have to tighten up. I'll try to show in just a few minutes that recessions actually originate in business, that's the precipitating area. Yes, Mr. Guasso.
Too far, but on that consumer confidence, are there specific ratios or categories used to determine that?
I'm sure they have specific questions that they're asking some selected body of consumers. I don't know what the makeup of the survey is, but I imagine you could find that out if you really wanted to. I think this is done at the University of Michigan, if I'm not mistaken. They're the ones who conduct a survey of consumer confidence. And I would imagine there's some website that would provide what the components are. All right. The way things stand in the immense majority of today's textbooks is saving is treated as hoarding. And investment is regarded as virtually coming out of nowhere. Have any of you ever heard the expression exogenous variable? Yes? Yes?
Yes.
Okay, what does exogenous variable mean?
A variable that's outside the system?
A variable outside the system. And isn't that applied to investment?
Yes.
See, investment is treated not as being the corollary of saving, but as an exogenous variable. It comes, in effect, out of nowhere. Now, in reality, what is saved is spent, what is saved is invested. That is the normal situation. And if we recognized, if our principle were that what is saved is invested, would we be able to think of saving as representing hoarding?
No.
No, people are saving. Those who are saving are spending less, but those whom they lend the money are spending more, or maybe the same people are spending more in a different capacity. Like if you have a saver who owns his own business, and I'm sure you have many cases where there is a businessman who decides he wants to improve the assets of his firm, and he personally will retrench on his consumption to accumulate the funds to spend more in his business. So there it's one and the same person who's spending more, but in a different direction. He spends less for consumption, more for his business. Yes, Mr. Foster.
Would I be right in the assumption that basically if we define hoarding, that would be taking lumps of cash and stuffing it under your mattress?
Essentially, that would be the essence of it.
With saving, you're making your funds available to a larger class of people by investing it into our financial institutions so they can be spent by other people.
Yeah, the way that people save, it's a rare, unusual situation for someone to save by putting his money under the mattress or burying it in a safety deposit box. When people save, the overwhelming norm is if they're not putting it in their own business, they're putting it into a financial institution, which is making it available for other people to use. That's absolutely correct. Yes, Mr. Castillo.
There's got to be a lot less people that believe in this. Saving is hoarding versus the contemporary economists, correct? I mean, they can actually see. I mean, there's a lot less people that truly believe this, right?
Well, I don't think that's so. If you just look at how the press describes things and how the textbooks, and probably there are many people who say one thing at one moment and the opposite at a different moment. So it's doubtful that there are too many people who 100% of the time would say that saving is hoarding, but I think most people say it more than half the time. They think of it that way. They think of it that way.
Wow.
And just think, when you read accounts in the newspapers, if saving is going up, what is that taken to imply? That spending is down. But now, on the other side, if you were to read investment is going up, what are the implications of that? That the economy is expanding. Now, what does this imply about a connection or lack of connection between saving and investment?
Lack of connection.
That there's a lack of connection. It would be comparable. Imagine we were living in a very primitive age, and we didn't know that crops came from seed. And we saw farmers are planting seed, but they don't know that the product of the seed will be the crops. They think the seed just disappears into the ground, and then miraculously, the crop springs up with no connection to the seed. Well, I think that's the state of contemporary economics. They think that the saving disappears into hoards, and then investment is an exogenous variable. It's coming out of nowhere. I think that's the level at which these things are described and discussed. Yes,
so talking about what's reported in the newspaper and in our general society, how do you relate this to the topic that we often see when it talks about consumer debt?
Yeah.
Our nation compared to China, for example, where it states that there is a significant amount more savings per individual in China than there is in Japan, mm-hmm. Than there is in the U.S.
Yeah.
Because I'm having a hard time grabbing your point, and I'm sure it's true.
Yeah, that's okay. You don't have to be sure.
No. I'm sure it's true.
Yeah.
That, everyone thinks that saving is hoarding. But when I read these reports about, really, quite frankly, the danger of where we stand because of the amount of spending of consumers in terms of debt, mm-hmm. It seems that it's viewed in a negative light.
Okay, to the extent that consumption represents great debt burdens, yeah. Then there is negative reporting on it. That's true. I grant that. But I thought you were going to make a further point when you referred to Japan and China, and you talked about...
I stopped short of being brilliant.
No. That would have been more brilliant. I know Japan, for many, many years, had an extremely high savings rate, and so did Taiwan and South Korea, and I assume the same is true of China. You know personally for a fact that the savings rate in China is very high.
Yeah.
Well, notice that goes hand in glove with the very rapid rate of economic progress that these countries have experienced.
Right.
So, in 1950 or thereabouts, Japan had been bombed very, very heavily. Its economy was pretty far down in the pack, and the essential ingredient in Japan's meteoric rise was a very high rate of saving, because that their saving did represent a demand for capital goods. So whatever limited ability to produce they had, they concentrated very heavily on the production of capital goods. Then they had more capital goods the next year than the year before. That enabled them to produce still more the following year, including still more capital goods. They kept up a heavy concentration on capital goods. And that's how they were able to advance. And it seems that you have the same principle being repeated in China.
Where I'm really struggling is, the reality is, I'm starting to have this picture of how messed up, we are in terms of what we're promoting, because if you look at classes here in the U.S., and you look at, I'm in the housing industry, and you look at the current amount of wealth in different groups. We take China, for example, the home ownership rate, and I would look at that as an investment as opposed to consumption, is much higher. And therefore, the strength...
We're higher than China.
Say it again?
I would assume that we're much higher than
in terms
China.
Of home ownership rate, yeah. I'm talking about... members, someone from the Chinese community who's in the United States.
Oh, okay.
The home ownership rate is higher.
Okay.
They will tend to spend less money on consumptive spending and more money on investing. And so, therefore, their growth and wealth is much higher than American born or individuals born here in America.
Okay.
In comparison.
Yeah.
So I guess my point is, I'm starting to recognize how, messed up what we're promoting here in the U.S. is, because if you look at which groups are becoming much more wealthy, those practices that are described over in China or in Japan ultimately produces much greater wealth.
Mm-hmm.
So we're messing up our own growth here in the U.S. by promoting that.
I think they work hard. That's a whole other...
You're saying we're messing ourselves up with a negative attitude towards saving.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd agree. But now, please realize, we didn't always have such an attitude. The United States used to be a very high saving country. Things have changed because we've had a major change in attitudes and also in institutions. And one of the changes is the type of money that we have. If you do save heavily, you have a huge risk that you won't be able to have too much benefit from your savings, because the buying power may be a fraction of what it is. That's a major factor for many people. And then we'll see there are other things, too.
What about available credit?
Pardon me?
Available credit. The credit that is given to people, there's much more, it's much easier now to give credit to people so they can pay back.
Well, it becomes easier to give credit if the credit is manufactured out of thin air by the creation of money.
Mm-hmm.
And then that leads to financial bubbles. I would think, I don't know for an absolute certainty, but I believe that much of the rise in the value of homes in the last few years has been on the basis of credit expansion. And when this stops, there could be a significant fall in the home values. Yes, Mr. Richards.
You mentioned that the United States used to be a country that saved a lot. Was there a defining point where that changed, where all of a sudden we stopped saving?
I don't know that it was a matter of all of a sudden, but I would think the rate diminished, and then it kept diminishing until where it is today.
Was there any cause of that?
Yeah, there's a variety of causes. Tax system features very prominently. See, just think, if we didn't have a progressive personal income tax, what would people in the upper brackets be doing with a huge chunk of their incomes that they now pay over in taxes? They'd be saving and investing.
Or spending it.
No, they'd be more heavily saving and investing for a variety of reasons. Let me just try to deal with this point quickly. This is something that's statistically observed over and over, that the higher the income bracket, the larger the percentage of income saved and invested. But there are solid reasons for it. One reason, and this I consider the lesser, is an explanation developed by Milton Friedman, and it's called the permanent income hypothesis. A significant part of the top incomes in the economy are earned by people who have who can only look forward to earning them for a very limited time. Let's say star athletes, movie stars, writers of best-selling books. You have limited careers, and maybe you'll only have one bestseller. Now, if you're thinking about your whole lifetime, and you want to benefit from your current very high income and benefit over the course of your lifetime, what would you have to do with this very high income? You'd have to save and invest very, very heavily. The way you'd be looking at it is, okay, I'm making a ton of money this year, but I don't know for how many more years, and I've got to provide for the next 40 years or more, so I can't afford to consume very much of this. I have to spread it out over the next 40 years. That's one foundation for high rates of saving out of high incomes. An even more important foundation, I think, is that the very highest incomes are earned as high rates of profit on capital invested. The really top incomes are going to people who are earning high rates of profit on their invested capital. Now, the means of building a fortune is a combination of earning a high rate of profit and then saving and investing very, very heavily. Suppose you started with $100,000 and you were going to grow this into $1 billion in, let's say, 20 years. Well, yeah. To do this requires some definite substantial compound annual rate of growth. I don't know precisely what the percentage is. Imagine it's a 25% compound for 30 years will do the job. That's a rough estimate. Well, what would you have to do? You'd have to earn a rate of return greater than 30% and save and invest enough out of that so that your capital would grow at a 30% compound annual rate. You'd have to be saving a huge chunk of your income to have a high rate of return, a high rate of compound growth on your capital. And I think that's a leading part of the explanation. Those in process of building fortunes need to save and reinvest very, very heavily out of their high incomes in order to continue earning that high rate of return on the reinvested capital. That's how they build a fortune. Then there's yet another reason closely related to this, and that is, it's similar, I guess, to the permanent income hypothesis. Suppose someone has accumulated enough wealth so that he could live off of it for the rest of his life. Let's say someone has managed to accumulate $10 million. And he could look forward, even if he's thinking that it would live for another 40 years, well, how much could you afford to consume each year over the next 40 years if you have $10 million? I think it should work out to about $250,000 a year, if I'm not mistaken. 10 years is $2.5 million. 40 years would be $10 million. okay, you could afford to consume $250,000 a year out of your accumulated capital, even if you earned no further income. Well, now imagine that you're able to earn 10% on this capital.
Yeah.
So now, instead of just having the 10 million, you'll have 11 million. But the 11 million has to suffice for 40 years. How much will you now be able to consume on the foundation of 11 million? Well, the 250 on the basis of the original 10, and another 25,000 on the basis of this additional million. Well, now apply the extra 25,000 of consumption, take that as a fraction of the extra income. That's 25,000 out of a million. What are you doing with the rest of the million?
Investing.
Saving and investing it. So I would say a major part of the explanation of high savings rates out of high incomes is that to the extent that these high incomes represent rates of return that are above the rate at which people are prepared to consume. Like in our example, they'd be consuming 2.5% of their capital per year. But to the extent they earn a rate of return beyond that, the great bulk of what they're earning is going to be saved and invested. So this would explain why we should expect that higher incomes would be very heavily saved and invested. Okay, there'll be more to say in connection with saving when we return in 25 minutes.